Okay, so I'm a long-term visitor of the KITP, and I can hardly remember my prior existence, but I'm actually from Germany, from a Max Planck Institute there, and I'm generally interested in quantifying evolution using models as well as relatively simple experiments. And I have been actually interested a lot in spatial aspects, or in problems, evolutionary problems, in which space cannot be neglected. So it's not justified to assume that the population is a well-mixed, is in a well-mixed container. And that's, I guess, the topic more or less of the next 2 weeks, so it makes sense to finally get to talk after 2 months. So, and actually my talk will tie in on clonal interference, which was a dominant topic in this well-mixed part of the symposium, and I would like to take this this problem to the next level and discuss it, what how this picture changes in spatially distributed populations.
Awesome.
Yes.
Is your microphone supposed to be working?
No, it's not a microphone, it's just for recording the talk. So clonal interference, I will introduce it better in the next couple of slides, but that's the phenomenon that beneficial mutations occur on different backgrounds and then start to compete with one another, and only one of them can win an asexual population, and that has been put forward as an argument for the evolution of recombination, which can mitigate clonal interference. And we will see that in space this this problem of evolution is even more dramatic. The range of parameters in which you observe clonal interference is broader. But you also have different types, different ways how you can mitigate clonal interference, not only by genetic mixing, but you can also spatially mix your population, I argue, and mitigate clonal interference. So then, by an extension of this Hill-Robertson hypothesis, we may say that any kind of mixing is evolutionary favored in the presence of clonal interference. So, but let me now, okay, review clonal interference, and for the long-term visitors, they can take a nap now because they've seen this at least five times.
Oscar, do you mean mixing is favorable or structure is favorable?
No, in a structured population, mixing is favored. And I will explain why. Right. I mean, you probably already sense why, but I will explain it in detail. So clonal interference, this problem arises when one starts to think about what happens if a population is first adapted to one kind of environment, and then we say E. coli enriched medium, and then we suddenly change the environment to sort of a harsher environment or unseen environment, like minimal medium, say. And then we just watch how the population gradually adapts over time. And here we're interested, or people were interested in how adaptation proceeds by the accumulation of new beneficial mutations that has to be distinguished from adaptation based on standing variation. And okay, so in this phase, then the slope of the fitness increase, so the slope with which the growth rate of the E. coli increases over time, that would be called speed of adaptation. It has been center of many theoretical studies and also experimental studies because, yeah, it can be studied in a very controlled way using evolution experiments. Lenski has done the most impressive one. It just hit, I think, 50,000 generations. And, okay, more or less, I think, understanding the slope is broadly consistent with the theory we have right now for the well-mixed case.
Is it obvious there has to be a slope and that it can't be changing all the time?
It does change over time, of course. But what's also interesting, how does whatever slope you have there broadly change when you change the key control parameters in your population, like the population size, mutation rates, and so on. And these tendencies can be predicted based on very simple models and compared with experiments. And that broadly agrees, as far as I understand. And so the simplest way to think about this adaptation process would be provided by this picture. So here, I'm essentially the individuals of the population are lined up on the x-axis, and time runs in the vertical axis. And this event here marks, or these stars marks, mark the appearance of new beneficial mutations that are also established. That means they have survived this initial struggle against genetic drift to go extinct. And this is actually very high, only with a probability 2S, if S is a selective advantage, beneficial mutations actually survive this genetic drift. But once they have done this, they essentially try to expand deterministically until they reach fixation in the population. And in this picture, the population waits until the next beneficial mutation arrives, which gets fixed, and so on. The whole thing is mutation limited and can be actually analyzed quite simply if you make a number of assumptions. So let's assume the population is well mixed of constant size n. We ignore the deleterious mutations. Let's say beneficial mutations occur at a constant rate UB, and the selective advantage is also constant, very small. Then it's easy to see that the total rate with which beneficial mutations appear is n times UB. As I said, they become established with probability 2S. So then the rate of fitness increase is given by this expression. I will always use this capital R to denote this fitness increase per generation. In this regime, it's simply linear in the population size, linear in linear in the mutation rate. And this has been called the periodic selection regime because it rests on a key assumption, namely the assumption that mutations occur one at a time and sweep one at a time. And that, of course, is only true if the time to fixation is much shorter than the typical waiting time for a new mutation to come. And I will call this waiting time for a new beneficial mutation T mute, and the fixation time T fix.
So, and does the notation at the bottom right imply that UB is a function of S, or is it could be two?
Oh, no. UB times.
Diploid or what?
No. I'm just, it's haploid. I assume haploid in the videos. I mean.
In the bottom right, there's UB of 2S.
Times S. It's all times. And, well, it rests on this inequality, right? The waiting time for new mutations to come is much larger than the fixation time. But notice that when we increase the population size, then inevitably we reach the other regime where this inequality turns around, and waiting time for new mutations is shorter than the fixation time. And then this picture is more appropriate. So here we see a first beneficial mutation arises and tries to expand. But while it's expanding, another beneficial mutation falls on the less fit background, also tries to expand. At some point, they two sort of collide here. And then the system is frustrated, cannot decide which way to go. And then the third beneficial mutation here, it decides the game, and this combination BC wins, essentially.
Why would it be frustrated?
Well, not frustrated. I'm just here in this example where I assume fit constant selective advantages.
Ah, okay, so it's if they all have the same.
Yeah, but of course this changes if you have a distribution. Okay, and in this much more complicated scenario, one typically finds, all the models find, complicated expressions, which I don't display, but generally one can say that the fitness gain per generation in this regime hardly increases if we increase population size, for instance. So remember, in this periodic selection regime, when we double the population size, we double this rate of fitness increase. In this clonal interference regime, when we double the population size, almost nothing happens. I mean, it depends logarithmically on this population size in this more complicated clonal interference regime. Why is that? Intuitively, the reason is that even though when we increase the population size, more beneficial mutations become established per generation, it's also the case that more beneficial mutations are lost by clonal interference. So here we see the beneficial mutation A, which has survived the struggle against genetic drift, actually goes extinct because it had to compete against B and then BC and went extinct. So this is very unfortunate. We cannot really do something about this initial phase where beneficial mutation struggles against genetic drift, but the second phase, it seems like that's a pity that we lose these beneficial mutations. And actually, biology has found a way to resolve this dilemma, and that is a recombination. Recombination can bring A and B together so that they can, so that these beneficial mutations are not wasted. And this hypothesis, that this is the reason for the evolution of sex and recombination, that's called the Hill-Robertson hypothesis. I think also Fisher-Muller earlier hypothesized this. Now let me, right, so here in the next slide, I just want to show you heroic simulations, actually, of such a very simple population with constant population size. Beneficial mutations have constant value 10 to the minus 6. Fitness effects are set to 0.02. Simulation is taken from Park, Simon, and Krug. And in spans 300 orders of magnitude in population size, just to check which kind of approximation actually works best. So the red squares are actually the stochastic simulations. And notice there's this first regime here, which is this periodic selection, this very easy periodic selection regime. One mutation fixes at a time. And then there's this other regime of clonal interference. And here one finds actually many different kinds of regimes and many different approximations. The regimes depend on the spectrum of fitness effects. Here it is assumed fitness effects are constant, but of course in general one should assume also a distribution of fitness effects. And as I said, one finds generally, Igor Rosin, who gave an earlier talk here, which can be seen online, gave a very good summary of all the various approximations that are around and regimes. What one generally finds is this weak dependence on parameters, and the asymptotic behavior actually is still somewhat under debate. So I'm displaying here one formula that has been derived by Desire Fisher for the clonal interference regime. It's here seen as the green line, and the green line fits actually the data very well in this clonal interference regime over, 9 orders of magnitude. But actually, if you then look at the inset, when you go even further to 3 order of magnitude, then the green line starts to deviate quite a bit from the simulations. And actually, this other approximation derived by Rosin, Brunet, and Wilke starts to become much better. So this is still...
Sorry, which one is the other? Which one is the magenta line?
I haven't displayed it. It looks more complicated. But I can give you the reference for sure.
Is it also log?
It involves logs. It involves logs.
So how do you do the simulation with 10 to 300 in the
clever tricks, I don't know.
And why should we care about it?
Why should we care is another question. But I think at this point it's also a matter of principle. You know, it's a complicated problem, and we want to know the answer to it. It's kind of curious how this can, how there can be still other regimes.
But isn't it somehow, this says that this reminds me a bit of the discussion in turbulence, right, where people have done for decades models of well-developed turbulence, and now they are finding that the transient effects, the approach to this asymptotic state is where the real systems are.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm just displaying the state of the theory to some extent, and a lot of people have worked on it since the 64, yeah.
Well, perhaps for different U and S parameters, the crossover can be in a more realistic regime of N?
Between this and that? Perhaps. We should look at the equation. I think they try to choose realistic parameters as far as they know.
And what did that, so in the inset, the y-axis is linear?
Is linear, apparently.
So the, whereas there it's
log. Right?
So that deviation is not so bad.
You're right.
As it maybe looks.
You're right.
Oscar, you hear it's beneficial mutation, right? Yeah. Okay. It could be higher.
It could be higher. Okay, perhaps then I don't know what happens then, out of my head. Okay, and this, okay, what is the source of the difficulty, you know, on the theory side in this regime of clonal interference? This is also, as you will see, a promotional slide. So, so if you look at the fitness distribution of these populations in the clonal interference regime, then it is very broad. You have many fitness classes. Most of the population is centered around the mean fitness, but then you have these more or less Gaussian tails. And it turns out, well, in this kind of display, the population resembles a wave that is traveling to the right here to higher fitness. And all the dynamics is actually driven by these most fit classes here. They are really the most important ones for the evolutionary dynamics. That's intuitively clear. But even for very large populations, very few individuals exist in these most fit classes. So there, the problem of stochasticity plays a very strong role. So understanding how the dynamics of this stochastic edge provides, I would say, the basic difficulty in understanding this dynamics. In general, this cannot be solved, but more or less recently I found that actually if you don't fix the population size strictly, but you play around with this constraint, then you can actually find models that can be solved exactly. Okay, and also, why should we actually fix the population size strictly? That's typically assumed in these models. Why not choose a slightly different constraint where the population size fluctuates? Turns out what really matters is the log of the population size shouldn't fluctuate too much. As long as you can achieve this by any constraint, then the dynamics and also the speed of adaptation comes out the same. And so in this exact approach, it has a couple of benefits, like you can get the speed of adaptation, but not only that, also the fluctuations of these waves, which are very important for understanding, for instance, the coalescence. And to all the aficionados, I would very much like to discuss with you during this week about this work, if you're interested, but this is not the focus of this talk. Okay, here...
So you're saying that soft cutoff is basically a way of getting the exact solution?
No, it's not really a soft cutoff. It's still a hard cutoff, but a different kind of cutoff. So you fool around with a cutoff and try to adjust it such that the math becomes simple. Okay, that's the only trick. If you do that, then you find a solvable model.
But you're arguing that the solution is more general than this...
No, it has the same universal properties of the original model, but you can get it sort of exactly, you can get all these regimes, and you also get fluctuations. You don't get only the leading order behavior, but also corrections to it. Yes?
Oh, yes, somewhat semantic question. So when you say strong fluctuations, you're still referring to the Seyfischer regime, or your basic difficulty is you want to go beyond the Seyfischer? Get stronger fluctuations still.
No. I mean, I'm not only, it's not only about the Seyfischer regime, but also the other one. I mean, it would be nice to have a model that combines all Phil Gerish, the Gerish-Lenski regime, Seyfischer, the regime by Rosin, Bonnet-Wilke, without...
But that other regime I thought you just argued is not obviously relevant in any realistic situation.
No. I didn't really argue it this way. I think Michael argued this way. Sorry?
I'm just trying to understand what the basic difficulty.
Yeah, I think the difficulty in all these regimes is treating correctly the stochastic part of the population, which is always sort of driving these waves.
But it's not very difficult.
I would say yes. I mean.
So you're not satisfied with the Seyfischer treatment. I'm just trying to understand what is it that we're...
Well, in their regime, in their asymptotic limit, I am satisfied.
Okay. So what is the limit where you are not satisfied with it?
Well, for instance, if you have a distribution of fitness effects.
Okay, very good.
If it is that, if you want to kind of mess it up a little bit, go further, add new things, right? It's nice to know.
Another question is, how can you understand fluctuations of this wave? Fluctuation of this profile.
Okay.
How can you understand the coalescent process?
Okay.
So are you treating, so when you say fluctuation, so where are they? Are they, is your, the tip of the wave stochastic or?
The whole wave is, of course, fluctuating. It's a function that is fluctuating wildly, not so much in the center, but in the tail, sure.
But for example, describing the fluctuations in the speed of adaptation, right?
That would also
which
be cool.
The Cy-Fisher approach does not do for you.
Yeah.
So that would be one of the things.
Yeah, that's also an purpose.
And do I understand correctly, it's a conjecture that you've tested with simulation that with your adjusted constraint change of the model that makes it exactly soluble.
Right.
But the result will still be generic.
That's right. But to me, it's intuitive because all the results so far are only very weakly dependent on the population size logarithmically. So it would be surprising if you allow for weak fluctuations in n, which is so that log n is still weakly fluctuating, but then the results should deviate strongly from these previous ones.
Yes. So is this population size constraint, this softer population size constraint, is it anything that can be implemented, for example, in simulation straightforwardly, or is it more like
an
abstract? It can. So you expect that if you simulate it with this kind of soft constraint, you really get the exact.
Yeah, I did that. It's awesome.
You did that, okay. All right. And with the hard constraint simulations, you at least approach
the truth. Okay. So this was the introduction. And now what I want to present in the following is work I did primarily with my postdoc Eric Martens. And we asked, okay, in this question, speed of adaptation, does dimensionality matter at all here? And we will discuss, I try to discuss the following points. So first, I just focus on asexual adaptation with the simplest kind of migration, where individuals just do short-range migration, or, I mean, on long times, it looks like simple diffusion. Then I will introduce forms of mixing. So first we introduce spatial mixing by allowing for long-range jumps. And we will see that this actually leads to a strong speed up in the rate of adaptation. And in the third part, then we introduce recombination. Also leads to a speed up, but actually not so strongly as the first one. And then I try to formulate this an extended Robertson hypothesis, claiming that, you know, in the spatial system, whatever increases the mixing, be it spatial or genetic, is under selection in the regime of clonal interference. And in the end, I try to propose an experimental model system. And here, input from you would be very welcome. So this is ongoing. So how could spatial structure affect evolutionary dynamics? And here I'm just flashing a couple of very simple experiments just to illustrate how space can affect evolutionary dynamics. So imagine you have two strains of E. coli. One is labeled, actually CFP is blue, but let's say it's red. Let's forget about CFP and YFP. So we have one strain which is labeled red, the other one, this strain is labeled green. And otherwise, they are identical, so they differ only neutrally. And we prepare a mixture of those two strains. So initially, our population is well mixed, well steered. And then we plate a droplet of this mixture on a petri dish and then just observe what's going on when this population grows in space. And what one finds for E. coli are pictures like these. So in the center, you still have the mixture you started with, but as the population grows, you see that the population really demixes. Okay, so the genetic diversity during this expansion becomes strongly reduced. You find at the edge only regions which are either green or red, and the only regions where you have actually diversity are these domain boundaries. And that's important for evolution, because then where can selection act? It can only act where you have diversity of different types. And these are these fronts. So this indicates that sort of selection is strongly, the efficacy of selection is strongly reduced in these spatial systems because of the creation of fronts. And we could show that the creation of these fronts or these domains is actually the result of genetic drift, which is enhanced in these spatial systems. I also show here that in this depends somewhat on the species. So this was E. coli. When you look at yeast, you find qualitatively the same, but a difference in the number of those trites. You find a very large number of those sectors, but the domain boundaries are almost straight here. If you focus on the details of these domain boundaries, you see that in the E. coli case, you see actually streets forming here. So this is a street of red E. coli in a sea of green, and in the yeast case, it looks much more regular. For a long time, we didn't know what's the reason for this, but now we have actually done experiments with round E. coli, where this is an image we just put like 2 weeks ago, but you see the stripes here, they become, so this is the E. coli case, but if you look at a mutant, which is actually round, then these sectors become, they look just like in the yeast case. So we really think now it's due to the case that, so.
And because you have that bulge now, that's an advantageous mutation?
Yeah, in this case, this is an advantageous mutation, that's right.
And two of them, right? Because you have it in both colors?
Yeah, what's going on there?
Well, it could be just that the inoculum is not homogeneous and you have some artifact there.
The important point here is that you get stripes rather than these jiggly.
Well, that's your important point.
Very interesting that the mutant seems to have happened to both colors.
Well, so this is really a recent result. I mean, I don't know what's going on in this respect.
Yeah. There might be something interesting.
Perhaps.
Like maybe the mutation is horizontally transferring.
Yeah, then we would have recombination in the system too. Nice too. Okay, so the previous slide was to demonstrate that in spatial system, genetic drift is strongly enhanced and leads to locally reduced genetic diversity and the formation of front lines. And here I'm focusing now on a beneficial mutation, which also occur regular in these systems. This is the case of budding yeast, and here during the growth of the colony, a beneficial mutation arose in one of these red stripes and leads to the formation of this sector, which is slowly growing over time. For me, the point here is that these beneficial mutations, they sweep relatively slowly. They sweep, I mean, in this, if we think in terms of these axes here, so time actually, for me, this axis is like a time axis because the colony is growing in the vertical direction. And the important spatial axis we have here is transverse to the front line. And there we see that the sector is essentially expanding at a constant speed. And that's very different to the Wellmix case. In the Wellmix case, when a beneficial mutation arises, just a second, the sweep is exponentially growing in time. Okay, and everything I will tell will rest on the difference between the dynamics of these sweeps. Here it's linear in time. In the Wellmix case, it's exponential. Yes?
So what is actually happening to the colony morphology? So it's a two-dimensional layer, and the density doesn't vary?
Oh, the density is, of course, goes to zero at the edge.
No, I understand. But for example, as your red thing spreads, does it become more dense?
In there?
Yeah, for example.
I haven't checked. So I'm usually just looking at these pictures. But you can see typically also without looking at the fluorescence, you can see these sectors, and you can also grasp that something is going on here along these boundaries. So there is probably also a change in density that could also be here.
Oscar, I think this is just a bit a quibble with your main point, but if it's a radial inoculant, it's not linear, it's a logarithmic spiral.
But to first order approximation, can't we say?
Locally, it's linear.
Locally.
This is a radial.
Yeah.
So along the line of the previous question, so do they still live, these bacteria in the middle?
They do live. You can take them out. They do not grow, but they
do not
still
grow.
Live. You can revive them, say.
And your so the idea that you can that you say the population is one dimensional at this edge, is mainly because that's where the competition goes on, right? So effectively,
yeah,
so, that's the thing that you need to look at.
Yeah. Thanks for the question. So all the growth that is going on here is happening in a layer close to the edge, and this layer of pioneers is competing with each other for colonizing this empty space here. And as the colony grows, this one-dimensional population of pioneers is serially diluting itself. So what we see here is actually already the result of an evolution experiment where we had continual serial dilution of this one-dimensional layer of pioneers. That's how we think about it at the moment, and what we see here in the back largely we think is sort of a frozen record of what was going on at the front there.
Yeah. Okay.
And can you do this also without the spatial structure? Like can you repeat the same experiment in a well mixed? Because here you're saying that the sweep is slower than in a well mixed population, right? Mm-hmm. I'm willing to believe that, but can you show that experimentally? Can you like sort of repeat the same thing but in a well mixed?
Yeah, you can.
Like,
in principle, you can take that mutation out and recompete against the green ancestor in a well mixed flask. But this will be a different environment too. It's not said that this. So this is a big problem for the experiments to do these controls, because of course what we are selecting for here is different traits. That what we are selecting for in well mixed culture.
You cannot mix, I don't know, somehow.
Oh, we can try to mix on the plate.
Yeah.
That would be really nice, but we were thinking about those things. One can try to do replica plating, and then so with a velvet press on the colony, and then perhaps re-steer the distribution of cells on the velvet before plating on another.
Yeah.
And then do serial dilution like that, but there are all kinds of artifacts that could come in. It's hard to do those controls. Please keep thinking about this.
You can also just turn the velvet a few times to mix.
Right. Who did that? So,
yeah, we were talking about that.
Yeah, we were talking also about this. So. Okay. So all this was to demonstrate. A crucial difference between the selective sweep in the well-mixed case and the case where we have a spatially distributed population. For instance, a linear habitat, this front, the habitat of this expanding front, for instance. So in the well-mixed case, beneficial mutations sweep exponentially fast initially until they then saturate in the population. And in the spatial case, these are straight lines here. And one may ask, okay, what's the speed of these traveling waves? There's also, 60 years of work have gone also into this question to calculate the speed. Ronald Fisher came up with the first proposal neglecting fluctuations, and that's the speed I'm displaying here. It depends on the diffusion constant. D describes how much individuals migrate during one generation, what's the variance of their position acquired during one generation, and S is the selective advantage. And this should then be the deterministic speed of these waves. It's found generically that genetic drift reduces the speed, can be much lower. Okay, now our question is, what changes when we have these differences in the sweep dynamics? First, let's look at the periodic selection regime. So now we add recurrent mutations to the picture, and first assume that the waiting time for new mutations is longer than the fixation time. Assume this in both pictures. And of course, The time-limiting step in this regime is waiting for new mutations, and therefore the fixation time really drops out of the problem, and therefore the speed of adaptation is unchanged in this periodic selection regime. But notice that because the fixation time in the spatial case is much longer than in the well-mixed case, it's much more likely that clonal interference occurs in the spatial system, because this waiting for time for new mutations must only be shorter than this fixation time, so that we have to think about several Fischer waves colliding with one another. Okay. And really the interesting thing is that already Ronald Fischer sort of anticipated this effect in his original paper, 1937, on the wave of advance of advantageous genes. So I'm quoting here from a paragraph where he does a number example for how fast are actually these traveling waves. And he doesn't specify the species, but he's thinking of one that's spread along a continuously occupied shoreline. He assumes that the displacement of young from parents in each generation is 100 yards, 90 meters roughly. Selective advantage is 1%. And what he finds is that the speed of this traveling wave is 12 meters per generation. Okay, that sounds really, really like a small number, a very, very small speed. And especially if the shoreline is long, then it takes a very long time until the speed is run along the whole shoreline. And he then also concludes, in consequence, at any one time, the number of such waves of selective advance simultaneously in progress must be large. That really points to clonal interference, right? We have to consider the interference of multiple such pressure waves generically if these habitats are large. And so I first present now a computational study of this clonal interference regime. And the assumptions that we make are the following. So we assume that the selective pressure is constant in the whole habitat. We ignore deleterious mutations. So this is quite analogous to the simplest models we find in the well-mixed case. We assume that beneficial mutations occur at a constant rate UB. They have a selective advantage of S. We also introduce distribution of selective advantages. I don't think I show the graphs here, but it really doesn't change the story. The habitat size is L. We do it for one-dimensional habitats and also for two-dimensional ones. The carrying capacity is assumed constant. We are in the strong selection regime. That means when a beneficial mutation survives genetic drift, that happens with probability 2s, then it sends out waves that travel with a constant speed v, and that is given by the classical Fischer-Kolmogorov result. And what we then find here is the following. So here on the y-axis is, on a log scale, this rate of adaptation. So this is again the fitness increase per generation in that population. And on the x-axis we have the habitat size. We chose the mutation rate to be 10 to the minus 6, 5 times 10 to the minus 6. And the speed of the Fischer waves in these examples is 0.1. And what we find is, first, a linear dependence that's expected from this periodic selection regime. The rate of adaptation just linear in the total population size. But then when clonal interference starts, the rate of adaptation really saturates. There is no apparent further dependence on the system size. So here we have no indication of any log dependence here. Perhaps we have to go still further out. So it seems to saturate. That seems like a speed limit for adaptation. This is the periodic selection regime. This is the clonal interference regime. When we play with the parameters here, for instance, we lower the typical selective advantage or the typical speed of those waves, you get very similarly looking curves which are displaced. Now, how can we understand this qualitatively? So these curves are very simple. All that needs to be understood is the crossover point and the saturation value. And these values you already get out from actually a very simple scaling argument, or actually just dimensional argument. We think about what are the key control parameters in the system that actually control how fast my population adapts.
Oscar.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more how you actually do the simulation? So maybe I didn't understand it. So you are planting these stars at some rate, and then they start crawling deterministically. Is that the protocol?
Yeah, actually, okay. Good that you understood. What you have is a lattice of points, and in each point, we effectively have just one genotype. And if we have, say, a front between two regions, so on one region we only have mutations of higher fitness, mutants of higher fitness, on the other side we only have wild type, then this front, this front will move, not actually in our simulation, not deterministically, but with a mean speed given by the Fisher speed, but then we also impose some fluctuations. So the front jumps with a certain rate to the right or to the left, but it's biased to the right. So it's a biased random walk that on average has the speed given by the Fisher equation. But there are some fluctuations around the deterministic speed.
Your simulations are individual based?
Yeah, but we have just one individual per lattice point. So we are replacing, so we are not modeling deems, that would be an alternative, but computationally much more intensive when you have on each lattice side one deem, which hosts sort of a certain number of individuals, but just one individual. And we do that because we know that the population, well, we are interested in the regime where the population is has a locally very reduced diversity. So essentially, in each deem, if you would simulate deems, in each deem you would have typically just one genotype, and rarely would have mixtures. So that, therefore, we simulate such that on each lattice point we just have one individual.
So it's like a Moran model where you restrict birth and death to the boundary of the neighbors, right? Like you choose one to die, you choose one to
replace. Yeah, the neighbors replace.
That's basically the
right
replacement.
Yeah.
My confusion is that, is this dynamics going to always give you this linear growth, or if you would call this other picture that was proposed, this individual-based model, have you tried if that will give you also an increase in the speed of? Because this is kind of the prediction in some sense, but if you impose that to the simulation, that's of course going to be fulfilled.
So okay, that's true. But beneficial, I mean, single selective sweeps that travel in form of waves, there have been tons of simulations that have established that they travel at a constant speed. Well, there is a transient, of course, until you reach the speed. But then they travel at a constant speed. And this has been, I myself did simulations like that, but they are computationally more intensive. Okay. So here we took a coarse-grained approach. We said, okay, there has been done a lot of research on these traveling waves. We now just assume that's what's going on. Each beneficial mutation gives rise to those traveling waves. And then we just impose the dynamics of such wave fronts on the simulation to speed up the simulation so that we can go to large system size.
So what's the condition on that this holds? Because it must be so that locally you always go rapidly to fixation, so you basically your problem is then a boundary problem of expanding boundaries between
right. Basically
monomorphic regions.
Right.
I could imagine other regimes where diffusion and genetic drift compete. So
yeah, I mean, so one important length scale is how large, how broad is my front, the front of these traveling waves. And that length scale is essentially given by the square root of diffusion constant divided by the selective advantage. That length scale sets the front width. for instance, if that would be on the order of the system size, we shouldn't do this, because then it would be essentially well mixed. But there's an even more important length scale that will come out in a second that describes the typical width of those competing clones. And when square root of D over S would be on the order of this length scale too, then we should also not do this kind of simulation. These are, I think, the two important considerations here. Yes?
Just ask you something. How does L is to your experiment? I mean, is that just the surface of the...
The circumference. That would be the circumference. But of course, here there's no curvature, so I should do the experiment in a linear fashion.
Yeah, no.
And you had the bulge, like...
Yeah, that's also complicates the story.
Yeah.
We hope that these simple models grasp perhaps the leading order behavior of all this. Yes. There was another? No. Okay, so the key control quantities in this system are summarized here. So first one, which we call mu b, is the establishment rate per unit length. So that describes how many beneficial mutations are established per unit length in my system. So this quantity mu b certainly depends on the rate of beneficial mutations. Then it depends on the selective advantage, because that describes the establishment probability. And it depends on the density of my population. The higher the density of my population, the larger this establishment rate per unit length. So mu b is essentially the product of those three things. Mutation rate, density, establishment probability.
So how do you exactly distinguish establishment from survival?
Well, establishment just means coming to a size such that growth is deterministic, essentially. So that essentially, here in the spatial system, these waves, so in reality, these fronts carry out diffusion plus drift, okay? And on short times, these two boundaries, they have a large probability to annihilate, essentially, okay? But when the clone has reached a certain size, then they start to grow deterministically. And turns out the probability to reach this state is unchanged to the well-mixed case. It's also 2s. For many models.
So the statement is that there is no, under any condition, regime where the spatial competition becomes important in a stochastic sense. That the extinction due to sort of spatial competition can only occur once you go into deterministic regime.
The stochastic regime, what do you mean?
Well, if I understand correctly, you're splitting, one way of thinking of establishment is, long-term survival, right? And, but if I understand correctly, you're splitting this calculation into two parts.
Right.
There is the short-term survival, where I don't have to worry about space, right? But I do have to worry about homogeneous fluctuation, which is how you get the 2S, right? So the standards are well-mixed, Haldane calculation, right? And all the interesting spatial competition is going to happen when proliferation, when growth is already deterministic.
Right. So I'm saying that... So you can make a model of deans, and then if the selective advantage is very large, right, then locally within one deem, the beneficial mutation will have reached already a deterministic size that when the deem is filled, the growth is already deterministic, okay? That's one way to get the result 2S. But it's too restrictive. Even if the selective advantage is much smaller, that you need to spread over many deems to reach this deterministic state, even then, you get typically just the result 2S. I'm not aware of...
But you limited the density of these beneficial mutations. If they were enormously dense, then even within 1D, there'd be competition.
Right. I mean, that's important, and that's a very important point, and also a point of future work on this. So there's another regime which I don't discuss, where you have clonal interference already at the level of single beams, and that might be in certain... Okay. And in certain scenarios, it might be actually very important. And you can certainly impose it in controlled evolution experiments. For instance, Michael Desai could do this. If he has these wells, he can just make the beam size within these wells sufficiently large enough, then you can have clonal interference within them also. Yes?
Just a quick clarification. So V is an outcome, right, of the dynamics?
V, no, here we impose V. Because this is a coarse-grained simulation. So we don't want to work again on the question how beneficial mutations, a single beneficial mutation spread in space. There has been enormous amounts of work to understand this, the speed of a single Fisher wave. Here we are interested in the collision of all those waves, and therefore we impose the speed, which we know from other waves.
So then this selective advantage then is only needed to work out the competition part, but not...
Well, the selective advantage, V is a function of the selective advantage.
Exactly, so
the second part is S determines the establishment probability locally.
Okay, so it's an effective guessing.
Just make sure I'm sure I understand. In your simulation, in your cartoon, you have straight lines, and that's approximate, but in reality, even with the wiggles, and then it looks like you have vertical lines where some of them collide, but in fact those are slightly tilted because it would
absolutely
be
right.
A miracle if they had exactly the same.
This would be the scenario if the selective fitness effects of each mutation would be the same.
Oh, just with the quantized equal increment model, similar to Fisher.
Yeah, and we played around with this.
An artifact of that.
Yeah, we have played around with this degenerate model and compared it to distribution of selective advantages, and all gives similar, very similar results. Up to prefactors. Okay, I explained this establishment rate per unit length of beneficial mutations. The habitat size, of course, is important, and the Fisher wave speed. And with this, I want to explain the rate little r with which beneficial mutations accumulate. So little r is just a rate compared to capital R, that was the fitness increase per unit length. The fitness increase is little r times little s. Okay, and then one can write little r quite generally as this expression. So if you would forget about this f for a second, if you just write little r is equal to total length of my system times this establishment rate per unit length, this would be the periodic selection regime. This would mean every mutation that is established also reaches fixation. In the clonal interference case, this is not the case. So we have to multiply it with a fraction, f. F is the fraction of all established beneficial mutations that actually does survive. So f is between 0 and 1. And this number has to depend also on these three control parameters, L, mu, b, and g. And you can make only in one way a non-dimensional quantity in the way by comparing the total length of the system with another characteristic length scale, which is given by the square root of the speed of these traveling waves divided by the establishment rate. Okay, this is a new characteristic length scale here, which describes the typical size of the clones when they start to collide with one another. And what I said earlier, for instance, if this, the width of these traveling waves, the square root of d over s, would be comparable to this length scale, then also this approach would break down. Okay, now we have this general scaling form. Now the question is, how does f, what is this function f? Okay, we know one limit for this function f when the argument becomes very small, so when the system is very small, then we know we are in the periodic selection regime, so f must be 1. However, when the system becomes very large, we found in simulations that little r really saturates. This can only be the case when f, when the capital L drops out of the problem. So f has to scale like 1 over its argument so that the L's drop out. And as a result, we find a very simple expression actually for the clonal interference rate of adaptation. It goes like, so this factor is trivial, that's just the scale of fitness increase per mutation. But more importantly, it scales like the square root of the fitness, mutation supply rate times the speed. Okay, so this is a very important prediction, we think, because you have to compare this to the weak logarithmic dependence that is found in these well-mixed models. There, the mutation rate is hidden in the logarithms. In the clonal interference case, in the clonal interference regime, here it is proportional to the square root of the mutation rate. And we think this is really testable. If you would do a spatial competition experiment with these, with E. coli, say, and you compare mutator with non-mutator, then the difference in adaptation rate should be quite large, because it still scales with the square root of mu. In the periodic selection regime, it is different. It's linear in the mutation rate. So this is a way to distinguish these regimes.
And you think the scaling is insensitive to the assumption of discrete quantized fitness?
Absolutely. We have checked this. Also, you can generalize to 2D, then the scaling would be slightly different. It goes like the mutation rate to the power of 1/3.
And you say 2D here, you mean like a 2D stepping stone model?
2D stepping stone model, that's
Can you tell us why? So, is there an intuitive explanation why L drops out? I mean, I understand that from your simulations, it must drop out, but.
Yeah. I'm sure there is, and I have been thinking about it. But then there should also be an intuitive explanation for the well-mixed case, why N essentially drops out. You can do the same argument for the well-mixed case, but the adaptation rate should be N times UB times a fraction of the beneficial mutations that are lost. And for large systems, the scaling is not any more linear in N, but it depends only logarithmically on N. And for that, I haven't heard an intuitive explanation.
That's pretty simple. I mean, it's just when you draw the wave, the vast bulk of it, you're just throwing out. You only care about the extreme high end, and the number in the extreme high end only grows logarithmically with increasing the main part of the wave.
Okay, I don't know whether I can do such a simple argument here.
I would guess that it's different, actually.
It must be.
I'm guessing you probably actually don't see the same kind of logarithmic dependence here, and it's really something.
No, not logarithmic. We saw in the simulations, no.
I think it's a different explanation.
I'm confused. So if you say that the speed is significantly larger here than in the well-mixed case, that also means...
Not larger. No, I'm not saying this. It's lower. So in the well-mixed case, everything is faster because these sweeps are faster.
Somehow it seems that you're studying the dimensional dependence in a way so that the zero-dimensional limit becomes trivial, where it would be mu to the power 1. Right? And so that would be if there were no clonal interference. So it seems like implicitly you're scaling the amount of clonal interference with dimensionality. If you just take these formulae, I think. So, yeah. And that is maybe counterintuitive. I don't understand.
Well, if you can generalize this argument to any dimension, and as d goes to infinity, the exponent goes to zero. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean d goes to zero.
Hickey's asking, are you suggesting that perhaps, as a function of dimensionality, we should recover the interesting non-trivial clonal interference?
But at least I'm saying I don't understand the crossover to
right.
The, because if I perform this crossover and set d equals zero, I find mu to the power 1, which we would understand it would be just no clonal interference. So that's while we, in the sort of other zero-dimensional way of thinking about it, we get a logarithmic.
Alternatively, Oscar, you could take your spatial diffusion constant and gradually let it be bigger and bigger and bigger until the interfacial width dominate is comparable to L.
Right.
And you should get back, I presume, the earlier zero-dimensional.
You're absolutely right. But then my approach breaks down.
You can't do that yet.
No, I can't do this kind of simulation. In this simulation, I have been assuming that I have, well, disparate fronts running through the system, not clonal interference within beams.
There's just another crossover function lurking around the sphere, right. Which would be nice to know.
I think it's somehow hidden in your statement that L doesn't matter, because I can imagine a regime where things depend on L. Because if you generate mutations, and then as you make L bigger, you generate more. So that would be then more compete, and you would get the classical zero-dimensional result with a logarithm. So somehow there seems to be two different ways of thinking about it: one where L matters, and one where your regime says L doesn't matter and some xi that matters. There should be another crossover with L over xi somehow.
I think all you need is a second argument in your scaling function, which compares capital L to the width of the Fisher genetic weight. And then that there are lots of crossovers we can consider. But it sounds like you've gotten this regime right, but there's another crossover to go back in a simple way and to answer my question.
I agree. Also, my argument for why drops L out of the problem is just look at our simulation results. So I don't have an intuitive, rigorous reason to believe this is the case. Perhaps when we simulate to even larger systems, perhaps then some kind of logarithmic dependence starts to appear. But anyway, it would be a correction to this result. So really, for experiments, what's really important is just that.
But it does mean that less mutations are lost in this 1D thing, right? And I mean, what I said before, in the well-mixed case, clonal interference slows down more severely the speed of adaptation. Here, it's only square root. So you would expect...
If you take the same, I will show this. If you take the same population and you start to mix it more and more, then you go, certainly, this is a way to go to the well-mixed regime, and you will find a speed-up adaptation. This is the next point.
But I don't think this is a correction. I mean, you know, if sort of for low dimensionality, this formula would get into the one, but then going down to log mu would be drastic. So.
But I think your problem is that he assumes that in the beams there is no clonal interference. Right?
Maybe so, that's the thing that changes
if
at some point.
To
at some
I think so.
You only have that left.
Yeah. I think that's.
Yeah, but I think that's where this width comes in.
Yeah, I agree.
Exactly where the width comes in. You have one individual per deem, and now you coarse grain it to be six deems and look at those individuals. If they can diffuse amongst each other on a reasonable time scale, then you'll be back to this clonal interference issue.
So maybe this no interference within beams is something that gets more severe a condition as you go down in deep.
Or as the diffusion constant gets bigger, you'll get it back again, I think.
I agree. It's an important regime when one has to look. Yes.
Also, maybe alternatively, we have to think not of dependence on mu, but dependence on n.
Right.
And so the very important thing here is that mu is mutation rate per unit length.
Yeah, it contains the density.
And the density and, right?
Yeah, for instance, if you want to increase the density.
Precisely. So ultimately what's happening is that the number of mutating individuals in each deem is really tiny.
Yeah.
So, which is how you got into this no local interference regime.
Right.
So, however, if you ask a question, so you have a plate, and you know the total number of bacteria, right, sitting on your plate, and then you can ask, so how, what the hell am I trying to say? How velocity actually depends on the total number. That would actually change the power, no?
So mu contains the density of the population, of course.
Well, I guess I have to think carefully about this, but I think at the moment we're comparing apples and oranges.
what are we comparing?
Well, you know, when we're saying that things depend on different powers of mutation rate.
So look at the mutation rate. Yeah.
It's not quite, you know, mutation. Your mutation rate has different dimensions from mutation rate in, say, the Cy Fisher.
Okay, so this mutation rate is the mutation rate per individual times the density of the population.
Correct.
Times 2s. Okay, but it definitely contains the mutation rate.
But it also contains other things.
That's right. But think about the scaling of the, in terms of the mutation rate. It's definitely square root mutation rate. Okay? And that's different from the Cy Fisher. So if you compare mutator with non-mutator in the same density, everything else same, there will be a strong difference.
In fact, so maybe the difference between the increasing L, sorry, increasing the number is that in your case, if you increase L, the fixation time increases linearly with L, but if you increase N, it increases only logarithmically with N. So those rare clones that have many mutations still take a really long time to fix as you increase L here, whereas in the zero-dimensional
right.
large N case, they can sweep through the...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, that the exponential, that these exponential sweeps that you have in the Wellmix case, that's much faster than what we have here, and that's the major difference that makes all the differences that we see here.
Right, it's not just, I mean, the scaling with the size of the time is different. It's not just that
yes.
the speed is different.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
In view of the time, may I suggest that we get to the long range thing or whatever? Because
so this is only that if you use this scaling from introduced before, you can collapse data from where you choose different parameters here, different selective advantages for the beneficial mutation. You can collapse them on one universal curve, sort of corroborating the scaling. Here I also showed, I don't want to discuss this in more detail, but for the experiments it's important. What's the distribution of fixation times, mean fixation time actually, of clones that reach fixation in the spatial system as you increase the population size. It's first linear in time, that's the periodic selection regime, where clearly the fixation time is L over V. And then there's a crossover to a funny regime where the slope is 3/2. Naively, one would possibly expect rather a slope of 2, because when you have the clonal interference, the domains between the different clones, they don't move deterministically anymore. They carry out some kind of random walk. And the most naive random walk one would expect gives a slope of 2, but what one actually finds is 3/2. But this would just detail. And now to long-range migration. So in many systems, including microbial biofilm systems, occasional long-range migration can hardly be excluded. And
just to remind us, we have today a very short, sharp cutoff at 12:30. So
okay.
To start the second talk at maybe 11:05. So
okay.
I think you can, like,
so for the important point of the talk, I need to quick, but I have to touch upon.
Okay, good point.
So here I'm introducing now long-range migration to increase the mixing in the system. So what I allow for is that individuals jump at a certain rate, small rate, from its location to anywhere else in the system. So I'm coupling the population genetic sense, an island model to a stepping stone model. And it's also a way to interpolate between the spatial system and the well-mixed one. And what's the effect on adaptation rate? We find that it's enormous. Even very, very small rates of this long-range migration increase the adaptation rate a lot in the regime where you have clonal interference. Again, in the periodic selection regime, nothing changes by this added mixing, but here the adaptation rate is strongly increased. The reason for that is sort of obvious. Long-range migration reduces the fixation times by the establishment of new clones. For instance, here, this would be the case without long-range migration. But then from that clone, in this case, another one is created, reducing the fixation time. And as a consequence, because fixation times are shorter, now clonal interference arises less frequent, because what we always have to compare is the waiting time for new mutations with the fixation time. And as a consequence, clonal interference arises less frequently, so more beneficial mutations can fix faster adaptation.
So there are many ways to introduce long-range migration.
Okay,
I just want to know which one you're choosing. Are you simply picking up something and putting it in random?
Absolutely. That's the simplest case I could imagine. We're also generalizing this now to fat tail, power law, distributed
power law, migration.
Absolutely.
Now, we think that there would also just be interesting to increase the diffusion constant, as we discussed. And then, that's also long-range eventually.
And this kind of long-range migration leads on long times to an actually exponential growth of the clones. It's easy to see, I don't go through the math, but the effective growth rate is sort of interesting. It scales like the square root of the rate for long-range jumps. Okay. There's a consequence in this regime, we actually predict that one should get the well-mixed results with an effective fitness coefficient that is given by this result. And you see there, it doesn't scale with the normal fitness advantage of the beneficial mutant. It depends on the migration rate for long-range jumps and the speed at which these waves travel. Okay, but the important bottom line is spatial mixing mitigates clonal interference and should therefore be selectively favored. Just like recombination, that's the classical argument for why recombination should be selected for. We also introduce recombination here. I just quickly go through it. The major point is it also increases adaptation rates in the clonal interference case, but actually more slowly than the long-range migration bit. Okay. We don't understand this regime, by the way. This is probably very complicated to understand. I don't understand it at the moment. But the main predictions, let me summarize it, are spatial extended populations are more prone to clonal interference because the fixation times are much longer. In clonal interference, we find a speed limit when we have just short-range migration. The adaptation speed scale is like mu to the 1/3 in two dimensions and square root of mu in one dimension. We haven't seen any log dependence here. And perhaps possibly long-range jumps are even more efficient than recombination in mitigating clonal interference. That at least was the case in our simulations. So let's formulate an extended Hill-Robertson hypothesis. Whatever improves the mixing is strongly selected for in the regime of clonal interference. And in the end, because this is how we want to actually test the whole stuff. So imagine you have a long racetrack of agar. You inoculate microbes on one end. You choose the length of the racetrack. And then you observe what happens as the population grows. And as I said, the interesting pioneer population is serially diluting itself and producing for you this evolution experiment, essentially, or the serial dilution. And what we would measure would be, as an adaptation rate, would be the speed of this expanding front and how it changes over time and compared to our experiments. Okay, with this, let me thank my postdoc, Eric Martens, and Fabian Stieve, who is now carrying out the experiments, and my collaborators at Harvard, David Nelson in particular, and people from which we got the strengths. Thanks. Yes.
So have you considered, with migration, have you thought of it in terms of modifiers? A modifier
Good
of migration.
Question.
Because such a modifier would carry a risk, right? If you're going to leave the comfortable place where you are and jump to somewhere else. So how would such a thing spread? I mean, it could be
it's
beneficial looked at macroscopically.
Especially if you think about biofilms. I mean, jumping into the river stream is dangerous. You can be just lost. But you might also find new, better spots.
Just a comment.
Yep. Yeah. Good question.
So your prediction that mixing is advantageous,
you're so far looking at mutations, at adaptive mutations that benefit the individual that carries that mutation. But there could be other mutations that, like secretion of substances that help other cells in the vicinity.
Right.
And then the prediction would be opposite, I guess. Well, mixing is not advantageous because if it's a mutation that carries an immediate cause for the individual that carries the mutation, but then it can benefit other individuals in the local vicinity. It's like
bad for cooperation.
Yes. So right now, the prediction that you made is restricted to individual level advantageous mutations, right? It's a mutation that only benefits the individual that carries it.
Yeah, so
of course, you know, going to the
you can make a case like that.
Is adding more complications because you need to take into account the local neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a comment that's restricted to mutations that are advantages to the individual that carries.
Probably there are a lot of assumptions involved. This is certainly one. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
10-minute break.